The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Monday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. On today's program, we'll hear from Kate Anderson. She's with Alliance Defending Freedom. Today is marks the beginning of the new term for the Supreme Court. One of the cases before the court has to do with the federal employment statute and the definition of sex. Well, we'll explain all of that a bit later in the 5 o'clock hour. We'll also hear from John Pollard. He's the author of The Accidental President. Today's program is produced by James Blend. Clark Hilton is today's engineer. Taking a look at some of the day's headlines, the White House announced late Sunday that Turkey will soon move forward with its planned military operation in northeast Syria, in an area where U.S. troops have been deployed and operating with Kurdish-led forces. The U.S. will not be involved in the operation, the White House said. The president spoke with Turkey's President Erdogan by telephone. U.S. troops will be moved from the area. Hours after the announcement, Kurdish-led forces in Syria reported that American troops have been withdrawing from areas along Turkey's border. We'll talk more about that and the fact that some in the military complex were blindsided by that announcement. President Trump on Sunday tweeted that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Representative Adam Schiff should be impeached over their handling of the whistleblower investigation. Trump said nervous Nancy was aware of the shifty Adam Schiff and his massive frauds perpetuated upon Congress and the American people. He pointed to Schiff's recent parody speech in Congress where he read a dramatization of the president's July 25th call to Ukrainian President Zelensky during acting director of National Intelligence Joseph McGuire's hearing. The president has been under an impeachment investigation over his interaction with Zelensky after it was revealed that he requested that Ukraine government officials investigate the Biden family. Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, improvised parts of the transcript for effect and framed it as satire. Trump was also apparently alluding to reports that Schiff's false earlier claims that the unnamed whistleblower did not speak to his committee. Meanwhile, there are questions that have now been raised over the delay between the actual phone conversation and the time that the whistleblower filed that complaint. The IG says there were 18 days, and that is being framed as something of a mystery. Well, the president's tweets on Pelosi and Schiff came as a senior member of the House Democratic Caucus said that House Democrats believe that they have the required 217 votes needed to pass articles of impeachment against the president, stemming from his controversial Ukraine call, and send articles to the Senate, even before the completion of their formal inquiry and planned hearings. The senior House Democrats said it's unlikely Pelosi will give in to the president's demand for an inquiry vote. The source said that while leadership hasn't officially whipped or nose-counted a vote to impeach, they believe the numbers were there based on the 227 votes already on record for an inquiry and were working under that assumption. Meanwhile, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham on Sunday vowed to expose the anonymous whistleblowers against Trump if Democrats move forward with impeachment. A second unidentified whistleblower was confirmed on Sunday morning, reportedly with firsthand information to support some of the allegations made by the first whistleblower who sparked the impeachment inquiry on the president. Senator Graham said that if the Democrats follow through on their desire to impeach President Trump, he will make sure that the whistleblowers will have to come forward and testify. It was a rough weekend for settlement talks in the now 4-week-old strike with the United Auto Workers against General Motors. Talks took a turn for the worst, hitting a big snag over product commitments for U.S. factories, a union official wrote in an email to members. The letter from UAW Vice President Terry Ditz cast doubt on whether there will be a quick settlement, too late for that, in the contract dispute, which sent 49,000 workers to the picket lines on the 16th of last month, crippling GM's factories. And the Supreme Court will launch its new term today, and a 5-4 conservative majority could be poised to provide the White House with significant legal and political victories. or setbacks for that matter. Such are the unusual dynamics now percolating from the nation's highest court. The justice's 11-year agenda includes cases dealing with Trump executive power over immigration, along with LGBTQ workplace discrimination, gun rights, and abortion regulations. All are teed up to be argued this term, with religious liberty and health care appeals good bets to be added to the docket. All will likely be decided in a presidential election year. And President Trump lost his bid Monday to shield his tax returns from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which subpoenaed part of an investigation into hush payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Well, there's been a reprieve. We'll tell you more about that later. The Associated Press reports a second whistleblower has come forward with information about the president's dealings with Ukraine. The reports further reveal that, crucially, the new whistleblower works in the intelligence field and has firsthand knowledge of key events. That's according to Senator Lindsey Graham. This is Kavanaugh all over again, Senator Graham says. Well, Trump has signed an order to prevent taxpayers from subsidizing health care for those in the country illegally. And Bloomberg Law finally retracts its false and misleading anti-Semitic story involving Department of Labor official Leif Olson. Presidential candidate and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was released from a Las Vegas hospital on Friday following treatment for what his physicians confirmed was a heart attack, according to the senator's campaign. And working level nuclear talks in Sweden between officials from Pyongyang and Washington have broken off. North Korea's top negotiator said late on Saturday, dashing prospects for an end to months of stalemate. Women and minorities are fueling an increase in concealed handgun permits, and monthly gun sales are up 10% since last September. On this day in history, 1985, Palestinian gunmen hijacked the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro in the Mediterranean. The hijackers would shoot and kill Leon Klinghoffer, a Jewish-American tourist, in a wheelchair and push him overboard before surrendering on the 9th of October. And on this day in 1991, University of Oklahoma law professor Anita Hill publicly accuses Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of making sexually inappropriate comments when she worked for him. Thomas denies Hill's allegations. On this day in 1992, trade representatives of the United States, Canada, and Mexico initialed the North American Free Trade Agreement during a ceremony in San Antonio, Texas, in the presence of President George Herbert Walker Bush, Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, and Mexican President Carlos Salinas de Gortari. And on this day in history, Matthew Shepard, a gay college student, is beaten and left tied to a wooden fence post outside of Laramie, Wyoming. He would die 5 days later. Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney are serving life sentences for Shepard's death. On this day in 2001, the war in Afghanistan starts as the United States and Britain launch air attacks against military targets and Osama bin Laden's training camps in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, 2001. And on this day in 2003, California voters recall Governor Gary Davis and elect Arnold Schwarzenegger their new governor. Finally, on this day in history, 2004, President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney concede that Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction as they try to shift the Iraq war debate to a new issue, arguing that Saddam was abusing a U.N. oil for food program. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back in a few moments.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back 20 minutes after 4 o'clock. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, the Supreme Court returns from its summer hiatus today to begin an election year term heavy on political salient disputes. Well, the High Court's document for the coming months is a genuine gauntlet of highly polarizing disputes that could make the relatively, staid group a bit more volatile. The justices will decide by June of 2020 whether a federal civil rights law prohibits workplace discrimination against LGBT people. The Trump administration can terminate the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals or DACA program. New York City's gun transportation regulations pass the Second Amendment muster. And a Louisiana medical regulation that imposes an undue burden on abortion access, whether or not that can stand. Well, as of Today, less than half the states have laws banning employment discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Federal legislation called the Equality Act, or the Equality Act, that would impose a single nationwide regime banning discrimination against LGBT workers passed the House in May, but stalled in the Senate due to concerns about religious liberty. Well, the Supreme Court is going to hear arguments tomorrow as to whether existing civil rights laws cover gay and transgender employees. Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act bars employers from discriminating on the basis of sex, among other characteristics. Sexual orientation and gender identity are not specifically enumerated categories. Two federal courts have held that Title VII's ban on sex discrimination covers gay employees, and a third held it covers transgender workers. In fact, we'll hear more from Kate Anderson on that at 5 o'clock in the second hour of today's program. Well, supporters of those positions say unequal treatment of gay workers is classical sex discrimination, since it punishes one sex for conduct that is tolerated when performed by the opposite sex. As one filing before the High Court reads, to discriminate against men who are attracted to men but not women who are attracted to men is sex discrimination pure and simple. Well, the language is limiting, and the question is how that's interpreted and whether or not lower courts can broaden the interpretation. Well, opponents of that view, including the Trump administration, say that comparison is logically flawed. Instead, the administration argues the relevant comparison is between a female employee in a same-sex relationship and a male employee in a same-sex relationship. They would be similarly situated and they would be treated the same. Well, gay rights advocates say that anti-LGBT discrimination encompasses the kind of sex-based stereotypes and associational discrimination the High Court has already condemned. Well, the government and its allies counter that the ordinary meaning of sex does not reach sexual orientation, and that subsequent statutes have banned discrimination based on both sex and sex discrimination, suggesting the former does not encompass the latter. The arguments over transgender status and Title VII are largely similar. They're taking up that case tomorrow. And again, we'll talk more about that with Kate Anderson at 5 o'clock. Then there's the question of whether or not the Trump administration can finally end DACA as they had promised. Well, after a puzzling months-long delay, the court announced on the final day of its last term in June that it would decide whether President Donald Trump can terminate DACA. It's an Obama-era amnesty initiative that extends temporary legal status to 700,000 foreign nationals who came to the United States as children. Well, federal trial courts across the country issued injunctions barring the administration from ending the program. And as with last term's disputes over a citizenship question on the 2020 census form, those judges said that the government's explanation for the move is inadequate. Well, unlike the census case, no one question Trump's fundamental power to end DACA at its inception. The program was a discretionary executive branch initiative, and the executive branch may choose to end it at any time. The Justice Department told the High Court in legal filings that DACA injunctions require the government to preserve a policy that affirmatively sanctions the ongoing violation of federal law by 700,000 aliens who have no lawful immigration status and no right to the policy, the policy's continuation. While the stakes are high, the justices could go as far as declaring DACA itself unlawful, meaning a future president could not simply reinstate it after Trump leaves office. The court will hear the DACA case on November 12th. Then there's a relatively narrow dispute over New York City's gun transportation regulations that the court's going to hear in December. It took on a greater significance in August when five Democratic senators filed an amicus or friend of the court brief that urged the justices to dismiss the case on technical grounds. Now, the lawmakers, they accused the court's Republican appointees of engineering partisan victories for conservative political interests and warned that a victory for gun rights would inflame the left-wing court-packing push. As such, the dispute is much about the court's response to political strong-arming as it is the Second Amendment. New York City's gun transportation rules forbid licensed gun owners from carrying their firearms beyond the city limits. It further provided that guns could only be transported to one of several authorized gun ranges. Plaintiffs who want to take their guns to vacation homes and shooting competitions outside the five boroughs challenged the ordinance, but lost before a trial judge and the second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Once the Supreme Court decided to hear the case, the city quickly amended its regulation, asked the justices to dismiss the case as moot, saying they had given the plaintiffs everything they sought in court. The Democratic amicus brief urged the court to follow that course. Well, the plaintiffs counter that the city could revert to its original rules at any time and that the Second Circuit's decision would remain good law unless the high court reverses it. Well, the case is the first Second Amendment issue the court has taken up since 2010. And though the stakes are rather low in this case, the case is nonetheless important, as the justices could use it as an opportunity to set standards for judging other gun rights issues like concealed carry. The court will hear arguments in that case on the 2nd of December. Well, the High Court announced on Friday that it would hear its first abortion dispute since Justice Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation last year. The case involves a Louisiana law. It's called Act 620, requires that physicians who perform abortions have admitting privileges at local hospitals. The regulation is similar to a Texas law the Supreme Court struck down in 2016, called the Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. Given the similarities between the Louisiana and Texas laws, the cases could foretell how the conservative justices will approach abortion precedents. The justices briefly encountered the dispute in February after the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said Act 620 could take effect. Abortion providers then filed an emergency petition at the high court asking the justices to block enforcement of the law while litigation continued. The court agreed on a 5-4 vote, the Chief Justice John Roberts joining the four liberals to grant that request. The Chief Justice's move was somewhat surprising as he voted with dissenters in the 2016 Texas case. Now, again, that wasn't a decision on the merits of the case, but whether or not a stay could be applied until it's finally resolved. The decision will turn on whether Act 620 imposes an undue burden on abortion access in Louisiana. The providers say three of Louisiana's four remaining abortion doctors are not able to obtain admitting privileges, which raises the question in my mind, why not? By their telling, if Act 620 takes effect, there will be one abortion doctor in the entire state. Justice Kavanaugh questioned that assertion in a short dissent from the court's February decision. He said there were factual uncertainties as to whether the Louisiana physicians are able to comply with Act 620. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals went further and said the providers had not made good faith efforts to obtain admitting privileges. Arguments in that case have not yet been scheduled. And then the court docket is sure to drag the justices into the political thicket ahead of the 2020 election, yet a task more unpleasant may await the chief justices. Well, the Constitution provides that the chief justice shall preside over the impeachment trial of the president. As such, if the House adopts articles of impeachment against Trump, Roberts will become the third chief justice to sit over a court of impeachment. The chief justice's substantive responsibilities as presiding officers are quite few. Former Chief Justice William Rehnquist quoted the opera when he asked about his experience of former President Bill Clinton's impeachment trial in 99. "I did nothing in particular and did it very well," he said. Still, the experience would be an unwelcome distraction from official business, most especially since Congress's sharper edges could prove irritating for a chief justice known to prize etiquette and good form. I guess is he'll find neither in those hearings. Well, a second whistleblower claiming to have information regarding President Trump's phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky has come forward and has already spoken to the intelligence community's inspector general, all behind closed doors. We don't know what was said. We'll tell you more about that when we come back from a break in just a few moments. Once again, we'll talk with Kate Anderson about one of the very important cases the Supreme Court will take up tomorrow. She's Kate Anderson with Alliance Defending Freedom. And we'll hear from John M. Pollard, author of Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
35 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, a second whistleblower claiming to have information regarding the president's phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky has come forward and has already spoken to the intelligence community's inspector general. Attorney Mark Zaid, who represents both whistleblowers, first told ABC News that the second individual is like the first whistleblower, an intelligence official, and his firsthand knowledge of certain allegations contained in the first whistleblower complaint, which wasn't based on any firsthand knowledge. Andrew Backage, managing partner of the firm handling the case, verified the existence of the new whistleblower on Sunday morning, saying, "I can confirm that my firm and my team represent multiple whistleblowers in connection with the underlying August 12, 2019 disclosure to the Intelligence Community Inspector General, retweeting the news from ABC's George Stephanopoulos. Bakage said he would not provide any further comment. They did not immediately respond to other requests for statements on the matter. Well, the first whistleblower was subjected to criticism from the president and his supporters based on the lack of direct knowledge of the president's conversation with the president of Ukraine, as well as what President Trump has called an inaccurate description of the call. Well, that complaint alleged that Trump pressured the Ukrainian leader into investigating former Vice President Joe Biden's son Hunter's involvement with Ukrainian energy company Burisma Holdings, as well as Joe Biden's involvement in the termination of the prosecutor who was investigating the firm. Both President Trump and Zelensky claim that no such pressuring took place. The first so-called secondhand information whistleblower got my phone conversation almost completely wrong, he tweeted on Saturday night. Well, after the New York Times reported about the existence of a second whistleblower, the president leveled similar criticism at them, saying, so now word is that they're going to the bench, and another whistleblower is coming in from the deep state, also with secondhand information. Well, Zaid told ABC News that he does not know if the whistleblower mentioned by the Times is the same new whistleblower he's representing. He did tell the outlet that both of the individuals he represents are protected by the whistleblower law aimed at preventing retaliation for providing information. The first complaint, which was filed the 12th of August, led to increased support from Democrats for the impeachment inquiry into the president, with House Speaker Pelosi expressing support for that effort after long resisting a push for impeachment from others within the party. Well, the role of the NC2A, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, reported more than $1 billion in revenue in 2018. The NC2A is also a nonprofit organization. Well, the role of the NC2A is to regulate student athletes from 1,268 North American institutions and conferences, and to organize athletic programs of colleges and universities. Over 82% of the NC2A's $1.6 billion came from the Division I men's basketball tournament. Now, remember, this type of revenue is generated for a nonprofit from the commercialization of the play, competition, use of names, likenesses, images, and video of student athletes, athletes who are regulated more stringently than the average student on any campus. Well, massive profits, however, are going to other entities despite strict limits on the benefits to the actual athlete. Well, scholarships and the provision of housing, food, and other academic benefits are truly of value for the men and women engaged in competition on behalf of their respective colleges and universities. The idea of intercollegiate competition is about sport and not about employers paying employees. But a nonprofit making over $1 billion, while universities and colleges have similar financial benefits from the use of players' images in lucrative video games, ads to promote gear and brands, is an arrangement that can be reformed to offer a greater benefit to those who make it possible, the student athletes. And whether that's in the form of a salary is a big question. That seems to be contrary to what the NC2A is willing to tolerate, but is it possible to compensate them in other ways? Just one contract shows the scale of wealth generated by these student athletes. The initial contract covering the broadcast rights from 2010 through 2024 between the NC2A and CBS and TNT, permitting the broadcast of the highly engaging March Madness tournament, was $10.8 billion. A contract extension on top of that to push the dates out to 2032 added an additional $8.8 billion. So in one contract, the NC2A has a guarantee of $19.6 billion by just permitting networks to put games on TV and online. Well, more funding needs to get into the hands of athletes or to benefit them as they're making their way through their college and university career, if you will. Because the enterprise of college sports is big business, there have been attempts to do this under the table, on the edge of the rules or whatever justifying label, through schemes of payment. Yet the NC2A has held firm on the demand noted on page 4 of its own handbook, citing the principle of amateurism, which says student athletes shall be amateurs and their participation should be motivated primarily by education and by the physical, mental, and social benefits to be derived. Well, how can more benefit get into the hands of these athletes, many from poor, broken homes, that will benefit most from education attainment and the earned scholarship? That's the big question. And for athletes in one state, they've decided to take matters into their own hands. We'll follow this story as it develops, and whether or not this passes legal muster. as there are challenges afoot. Well, congressional Republicans are blasting Democrats for charging ahead with subpoenas to the White House for information related to the Ukraine controversy with impeachment inquiry in their rearview mirror, well, actually in their front mirror, claiming they do so without consulting GOP members. Republican members of the House Oversight Committee, led by Ranking Member Jim Jordan, pinned a letter to Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings late Thursday, requesting he hold off on plans to issue subpoenas to the White House and allow members, all members on both sides of the aisle, to debate and vote on whether to take action and under what conditions actions might be taken. You decide to issue the subpoena without consulting Republicans and without allowing members to debate the terms of the subpoena, Jordan and fellow Republican members wrote on Friday. Your memorandum cherry-picks and misstates information to propagate a misleading narrative about the president's actions, end quote. While they claim such a move would prove the partisan nature of their probe and would violate a bipartisan agreement that had to consult with each other on subpoenas. We object strongly to the issuance of this subpoena and your stated reason for issuing it, they continue. If you proceed with this subpoena over our objections, you will be violating our bipartisan agreement about subpoenas, trampling on long-held minority rights in the House of Representatives, and proving the partisan nature of your inquiry. Well, the letter is just the latest incidence of Republicans complaining over the Democrats' handling of the impeachment probe. On Thursday of last week, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, he urged House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to suspend the impeachment inquiry until equitable rules and procedures are set up, and criticized her for the swiftness and recklessness which House committee chairs have acted. Unfortunately, you have given no clear indication as to how your impeachment inquiry will proceed, including whether key historical precedents or basic standards of due process will be observed, McCarthy wrote in a letter to the House Speaker, also pleading to ensure Republican participation in that process. Relatedly, Trump is expected to send a letter to Pelosi that I'm not sure has been done yet, but anyway, daring her to hold a vote on Democrats' impeachment inquiry. The letter will say that the White House won't comply with the Democrats' investigation because Pelosi hasn't codified the probe with a formal vote on the House floor. The Speaker showed no sign of backing down, however, writing back to McCarthy, the existing rules of the House provide House committees with full authority to conduct investigations for all matters under their jurisdiction, including impeachment investigations. There is no requirement under the Constitution, under impeachment investigations, House rules or precedent that the whole House vote before proceeding with an inquiry into impeachment. The Republican complaints come as House Democrats intensify and widen their impeachment inquiry. Last week, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, and Elijah Cummings sent a subpoena to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Friday is the deadline for him to comply with that subpoena. The move will likely fuel Democrats' case and could prompt obstruction allegations if he failed to do that by that deadline. Well, President Trump has granted at least a brief reprieve on Monday after a federal judge issued a scathing order allowing the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to subpoena his tax returns from accounting firm Mazars USA. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals put the subpoena on hold after the president's attorneys filed an emergency appeal. We are very pleased that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit has issued a stay of the subpoena issued by New York County District Attorney Cy Vance. The president's attorney, Jay Sekulow, said the administrative stay will only be in place while the court reviews the case, and it's not clear how that will resolve. U.S. District Court Judge Victor Marrero earlier Monday was unsparing toward the president's legal team as he dismissed the president's lawsuit seeking to block the subpoena. He was appointed by then President Bill Clinton, wrote that the expansive notion of constitutional immunity invoked here to shield the president from judicial process would constitute an overreach of executive power, and that Trump's arguments essentially claims that a constitutional domain exists in this country in which not only the president, but derivatively relatives and persons of business entities associated with him in potentially unlawful private activities are in fact above the law, end quote. Well, the subpoena, which covers records from the January of 2011 through the present, is part of an ongoing probe of the Trump Organization by District Attorney Cy Vance's office. Trump argued that Mazars USA should not have to release the tax records because sitting presidents should be immune from state investigations. Marrero, the judge, ruled that the federal court should abstain from the matter as the investigation is part of an ongoing state prosecution, recognizing that an appellate court may take issue with this decision. He sought to explain at length why he was rejecting the president's immunity claim and denying the request for an injunction against the subpoena. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. In our second hour, we'll talk with Kate Anderson about one of the major cases the Supreme Court will hear arguments regarding tomorrow. Kate Anderson from Alliance Defending Freedom, and we'll hear from John Pollard, Chester A. Arthur, the accidental president.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
51 minutes after 4 o'clock is our time. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show, brought to you in part today by Zero Res. Democratic presidential candidate Senator Elizabeth Warren raked in $24.6 million during the July-September fundraising quarter. That's blowing past the former Vice President Joe Biden, coming close to Senator Bernie Sanders' field-leading haul. Well, the figure affirms the momentum Warren has appeared to be gaining in recent weeks and months. Polls show her now battling Biden, once the unrivaled frontrunner for the primary lead. And while Sanders remains in third position in many polls, his fundraising is unmatched, totaling $25.3 million in the third quarter. But Warren's campaign cash number comes close and is far ahead of the $15.2 million raised by Biden in the last quarter. Warren and Biden are essentially tied for the lead position in most recent national and early voting state Democratic nomination polls. The Massachusetts senator, who's produced one progressive policy proposal after another, announced her fundraising figures on Twitter, saying, "I'm grateful down to my toes for every grassroots supporter who chipped in. Together, we're building a movement that's going to put power back in the hands of the people." Warren's third quarter haul is up nearly $6 million from what she raised during the April-June quarter. Her campaign announced that they received 943,000 contributions from more than a half million individual donors, with 300,000 of those donors giving for the first time. And they reported that the average contribution to Warren was $26. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg reported $19.1 million this quarter. Senator Kamala Harris of California reported bringing in $11.6 million in the third quarter, with tech entrepreneur Andrew Yang hauling in $10 million, triple what he raised in the second quarter. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey announced he raised to over $6 million. Best-selling spiritual author Marianne Williamson said she raised over $3 million, and Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, $2.1 million. President Trump's reelection team, meanwhile, blew past all of them. Of course, that's divided by how many members are still in the running, but his reelection team blew past all of them. The campaign announced that it had it and the Republican National Committee combined had brought in a massive $125 million in the third quarter. Asked during a campaign stop in California on Thursday how she would compete with the president's massive war chest if she reaches the general election, Senator Warren touted her grassroots movement and highlighted that's going to be our comparative advantage to win in November. Tuesday was the first time, and of course that's November 2020, Tuesday was the first time campaigns could announce their third quarter numbers, but they have until the 15th of October to file their fundraising reports with the Federal Elections Commission. Campaign cash is a pretty crucial barometer of a candidate's appeal and popularity and of his or her campaign strength. Fundraising dollars can be used by the candidates to pay for campaign staff and grassroots outreach efforts, travel, and ads. Meanwhile, House Speaker announced $1 million is going to be used to shore up those candidates where Donald Trump won in their states to try to keep them in the House. And the White House announced late Sunday that Turkey will soon move forward with a planned military operation in northeast Syria, as U.S. troops who've been deployed and operating with Kurdish-led forces in the area began pulling back from their positions. That decision sent shockwaves through the region and in Washington, with U.S. officials saying that top Pentagon officials were completely blindsided and shocked by the order to pull back hundreds of U.S. troops, a move that effectively greenlights the Turkey operation. President Trump spoke with Turkey's President Erdogan by telephone. Some officials see the move as a betrayal of the Kurds, whom the U.S. supported against ISIS for years. Speaking on Fox and Friends Monday morning, Senator Lindsey Graham called it an impulsive decision by Trump that would undo U.S. gains in the region and give ISIS fighters a second lease on life. He tweeted, "If press reports are accurate, this is a disaster in the making," end quote. But the president vociferously defended the decision in a string of tweets early Monday morning, saying the ISIS caliphate has been defeated and lamenting that the U.S. was in the region years longer than planned. Reprising the rhetoric on foreign wars he has often used on the campaign trail, he described the fight as a regional conflict for Turkey and other countries to wage, not America's problem. The United States was supposed to be in Syria for 30 days. That was many years ago. We stayed and got deeper and deeper into battle with no aim in sight. When I arrived in Washington, ISIS was running rampant in the area. We quickly defeated 100% the ISIS caliphate. Bit of an overstatement, he went on to say. As for the Kurds, he tweeted, the Kurds fought with us, but we've paid massive amounts of money and equipment to do so. They have been fighting Turkey for decades. I held off this fight for almost 3 years, but it's time for us to get out of these ridiculous, endless wars, many of them tribal, and bring our troops home. We will fight where it is in our to our benefit, and only fight to win. Turkey, Europe, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Russia, and the Kurds will now have to figure the situation out and what they want to do with the captured ISIS fighters in their neighborhood. The president voiced confidence that the U.S. will still be able to crush ISIS again if they threaten the United States. Meanwhile, General Jack Keane said Trump's Syria withdrawal is a betrayal and would be a strategic blunder. There's one word to describe this for me, he said, betrayal. I think it's a strategic blunder that will have significant implications, he went on to say. We went into eastern Syria to defeat ISIS. The Syrian Democratic Forces, which the Kurds were a part of, had 60,000 group troops. We provided 2,000 of them to help them. It took us 2 years. We fought every single day to defeat ISIS. The Syrian Kurds, who we're talking about here, lost over 11,000 in that fight. And now we're trying to keep our foot on their throats so they don't emerge again in eastern Syria. And they're already showing some activity, he continued. How can we possibly walk away from them? Well, this is a back and forth. However, according to the Kurds, U.S. troops, U.S. forces are already backing away from that region as Turkey prepares to enter in. Well, the rest of the world was watching the pomp and circumstance and speeches celebrating China's 70th anniversary on Tuesday. But military analysts were glued to another spectacle in the heart of Beijing, the arsenal of cutting-edge weaponry that's capable of challenging U.S. military might for decades to come. Well, that lavish event marked 7 decades of Communist Party rule, gave Beijing a golden opportunity to showcase new hypersonic missiles, top-of-the-line drones, tanks, stealth bombers, unmanned underwater vehicles, helicopters that rival U.S. Black Hawks, and a host of other military technology that highlights the nation's ever-rising defense budget and its long-term plan to cut into American superiority in Asia and beyond. Analysts call the display a clear warning to the West and an indication that China's military progress, already at the point where Beijing is likely capable of going toe-to-toe with the U.S. in the Pacific, is accelerating at a rapid pace. Pentagon officials say the strategy to counter China acknowledges the new paradigm and the uncomfortable truth that unquestioned U.S. power may be a thing of the past. We're no longer in a period of overwhelming American dominance, but rather one in which our armed forces are adapting to fight against near-peer competitors who are fielding increasingly sophisticated capabilities. That's a quote from Randall Shriver, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs, speaking to an audience at the Brookings Institution in Washington just hours after the parade. Instead of expecting to dominate an opponent, our armed forces are learning to expect to be contested throughout a fight while achieving the political objectives set before them. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. News and traffic up next. When we return, we'll hear from Kate Anderson regarding one of the cases the Supreme Court will hear arguments regarding tomorrow.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed suit over the discharge of an employee who refused to comply with the Michigan Funeral Homes sex-specific dress code. It requires employees to dress in a manner that's sensitive to grieving family members and friends. Well, the EEOC attempted to force the business to allow a biologically male employee to wear a female uniform while interacting with the public. Well, it's gone to court. And here to tell us the story from its beginning to where it stands today is my guest, who is Kate Anderson. She serves as third chair in the case that's going to be heard on October 8th. She is counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you so much for joining us, Kate.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin at the beginning of this case. We've talked about it here on the program before, but I want to make sure our listeners know its beginning and where we stand now.
Yeah, so this case really is about whether Americans can rely on the law as it's written rather than what unelected officials want it to say. And what happened here was we had a business, Harris Funeral Home. They've been in business for over 100 years, serving grieving families in the greater Detroit area. They had a funeral director who worked for them, a male funeral director, who had worked for them for about 6 years when he came to the owner and told the owner that he no longer planned to comply with the dress code, a dress code that was in place to help the grieving families. The owners thought about that. He took some time to think about it, thought about the impact it would have on both this employee, other employees, as well as the families that they serve, and concluded that he really needed this employee to follow the male dress code. They ended up parting ways, and this employee filed a complaint. And then, as you described, the EEOC took this over and pushed this to try to make a change in the law to add gender identity to the understanding of sex.
Really interesting. Now, this employee, I think it's important to point out, had agreed at the time of his employment, this is this dress code standard. He had agreed to that standard, but then some time later, when he decided he wanted to present as a female, decided he was no longer willing to comply with the standard he had agreed to at the time of his employment.
Yes, and he had followed that dress code for 6 years as well.
Now, the law says that uses the word sex as opposed to gender identity, and how that word or phrase is being applied really is at the heart of all of this. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit ruled in this case that the federal government can force Rost and his business to allow a male funeral director who identifies as female to violate the business's professional dress code, a code that in accord with industry standards and federal law, by dressing as a woman when ministering to grieving families. Now, why is it important whether or not the word sex is defined or one's gender identity in these kinds of cases? And what are some of the broader implications that I think are important to emphasize as well?
Absolutely. So the question before the court is whether sex, that term in federal employment law, is going to mean sex, biological sex, which is what it's meant since the laws were passed in 1964, or if that's going to be now gender identity. And the consequences of that are significant, particularly for women. Sex discrimination law that has developed under this employment statute has been about promoting women's ability to be in the workforce, to be treated equally in the workforce. And it prevents employers from treating men and women differently, from favoring men in particular. And so if you start changing this to be gender identity, that breaks that down. And we've seen that happen in places where gender identity has been added or read into the law. For example, we're seeing it with women's athletics come up quite a bit now. There are cases in Connecticut where high school athletes in the track, they're losing competitions to boys who are presenting as girls and then competing with the girls. So two boys took 15 spots that were held at the state level by girls previously in track. We're also seeing it in the privacy context. For example, in Anchorage, Alaska, there is a women's shelter that provides overnight places for women to sleep who have been sex trafficked, who have been raped, who have been victims of domestic violence. And Anchorage tried to use gender identity to force that shelter to admit a biological man who presented as a woman and wanted to sleep in that shelter, which would have put him just feet away from women who have experienced trauma. So those are the kinds of things we're seeing happen, and those are the kinds of things that will continue to happen and happen on a broader scale if we make that kind of a change in the law.
Yeah, absolutely. I was an athlete in university. I earned a scholarship. If I had had to compete against males as a high schooler, I probably would not have had that opportunity. So it's not just a matter of winning a singular race or losing to a biological male. It has much broader implications for the future of women in athletics, for their eligibility for scholarships and so on. So this is it's an important issue that must be resolved. And it's Congress who defines the words that are used in employment statute, not judges. In this case, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit and other courts. Now, where does it stand now? Is the Supreme Court prepared to take this case on?
Yes, the Supreme Court has taken this case, and oral argument before the court will be on October 8th.
One of the things that's fascinating to me is the level of support in briefs that have been filed in favor of this funeral home, recognizing the broad implications. 48 members of Congress have filed a brief in this case. 15 states agreed, urging the court in their brief to leave to Congress and to the political process any decision to make a different policy choice based on the words that are being used. So it's had pretty broad support in terms of briefs that have been filed in favor of your client.
Absolutely. And we've seen people who we don't necessarily see often weigh in on these issues. For example, the Women's Liberation Front weighed in on this with a brief talking about the very issues we have, how women in athletics and in many areas of life will be negatively impacted by this decision.
One of the statements they make in their report, their brief, is that if a matter of law, anyone can be a woman, then no one is a woman, and sex-based protections in the law have no meaning whatsoever. And then they went on to talk about the ruling. Are you optimistic moving forward that this is going to be a successful effort, not only to preserve the rights of this funeral home in terms of its employees, but the broader implications for Title IX and Title VII and women who have been protected by law from unfair advantage that might be given to those of other biological, the other biological sex?
We are optimistic in this case because it's a pretty simple, definite question. Does sex mean biology, as it has for the last 50-some years, or does sex mean gender identity? And we think that the textual reading of the statute is very clear and that the court should recognize the public understanding of sex that has been in place for so long. And as long as that stays intact, the protections for women and for others under the statute will also stay intact.
How on earth did the U.S. District Court for the 6th District, how did they get it so wrong? That's a loaded question.
They did try to rewrite the statute. They've read into it gender identity, which is exactly what the EEOC initially pushed, and the government has since changed position. It's now the ACLU pushing this position, but unfortunately, the 6th Circuit agreed that sex could mean gender identity when that's not the way the statute has ever been interpreted by the Supreme Court, certainly. So we're quite hopeful that the Supreme Court will reverse that.
Well, let me just say how much I appreciate the work of Alliance Defending Freedom. I am a personal donor to the work that you do, and I would encourage other listeners to do the same. In fact, you can find out more at our website, ChristianOutlook.com, to learn more about their work and how we can support their efforts on our behalf. I appreciate so much your taking the time to talk with us. I know that you're serving as the third chair for this case that's coming up very shortly. So your time is precious, and I appreciate that you gave some of it to us today.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. Again, ChristianOutlook.com if you'd like more information about ADF or Alliance Defending Freedom. They do great work, great organization.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, a rich New Yorker who never before held an elected position in his life was thrust into the highest office in America, President of the United States. Well, because of his background in machine politics, the country groaned when he became president, expecting him to fail. Well, instead, he surprised them all by reforming deep-set corruption in the swamp. Well, in Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President, my next guest, John M. Pafford, paints the portrait of how the unlikeliest man to become president unexpectedly rose to the occasion and led America in its first step to becoming a world power. Well, Dr. Pafford is a retired professor of history and philosophy at Northwood University in Midland, Michigan, and the author of Cleveland, The Forgotten Conservative, as well as biographies of Russell Clark and John Jay. He joins us today to talk about the president you may not have given much thought to in recent days, Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Pafford.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Well, it's such a fascinating thing to look back at someone who is in the 21st century considered relatively obscure and consider the contribution that he made. What urged you to select Chester A. Arthur, who was an accidental president? We'll talk about that in a few moments, to write a biography about.
It was really the thrill of discovery for me. I was very familiar with our presidents in general, and of course with the better known ones in particular. We've had a number of presidents who become famous because of what they achieved in office or because they were president during particularly crucial times in our history, say such as major wars. And the lesser-known president did intrigue me, because I was wondering initially as to whether there was anything there that I've been missing that people should really know about. And I won't get into some negative names, but there are some of the presidents about whom I don't really think there's that much as that admirable in some cases, and other cases that's not that fascinating. But about Chester Arthur, yes, there was a great deal of interest. He had never held any elective office. He had started off well in life, entering college, Union College in upstate New York, at the age of 15, graduated in 3 years, Phi Beta Kappa, did some school teaching, then got into private study for the law. At that time, it wasn't required, if you wanted to be a lawyer, that you had to go to law school. You could go to law school, they did exist, but you could also study privately and pass the bar exam. He did that in New York City, became well known for taking what was referred to as the Lizzie Jennings case in 1854. This is a black woman teacher, Lizzie Jennings, who was kicked off a streetcar in New York because of her race. It was reserved for whites only. He took the case, and he won it for Lizzie Jennings. She was awarded damages. And a bit later that same year, the city of New York removed all racial restrictions from the streetcars. So slowly things were starting to change. But then he became a typical machine politician. He did well financially. He did hold the position of collector for the Port of New York, made a lot of money doing that. He's part of a machine in New York. He's not personally corrupt in the sense that he's not dipping his hand into the cookie jar and pocketing money for himself. But those who worked under him, there are about 1,000 people who worked under him in the Port of New York, those people all required to pay dues into the Republican Party of New York. So he's become a typical machine politician as we move towards the year we're going to be talking about primarily, 1880.
What made him attractive as a vice presidential running mate?
New York State. He was a powerful, he's an upper-level machine politician. He was powerful in New York. He's part of the Roscoe Conkling machine. So he's very, he's an upper-level lieutenant of Roscoe Conkling. The other key individuals who might have been chosen ahead of him, some office holders in New York, really weren't interested in the vice presidency. But there are only a couple ahead of him. He really did have a high ranking in New York. So he was put on the ticket with James Garfield to deliver the votes of New York. Garfield was representing the reform element of the Republican Party, but the Republicans were practical enough to know they weren't going to win without New York, and Garfield was supposed to deliver New York, and he did. And so stepped in as vice president.
Now, President Garfield served until his assassination, at which point Chester A. Arthur became the president of the United States. What kind of president was Garfield for Arthur to follow? And why were there such low expectations for this man who was chosen essentially for geographic reasons?
Right. The presidency that might have been under James Garfield is one of those unanswered questions in history. There are historians who argue that he would have been a good, solid, successful president. Others think he might not have been that strong. I think that he would have been an honest president, a good one, not one of our great ones. He would have been a good one. But he was shot, fatally wounded, died of infection. The wound would not necessarily, would not have been fatal today, but he is dead in September, and so he's barely president for 6 months. Now Arthur is going to be in there for 3.5 years, and he's going to turn out to rise above his machine roots. That's going to surprise people. As you well know, in American politics, more often than not, we get negatively surprised mm-hmm. by somebody we think is going to be a great president, a reformer, somebody we really want in there. And it's rare for us to be pleasantly surprised by somebody of whom we expected virtually nothing, and he turns out to be good. So first of all, for Arthur, his machine buddies in New York were quickly disappointed in him because he was determined to be president of all the American people, not just to represent the interests of the New York machine. And the reform wing of the Republican Party, those who liked Garfield, really didn't trust him. And it's going to take a long time, and some of them never will fully trust him. So he's got some support in the Republican Party, but it's definitely a minority foundation that he has between those who regard him as having sold him out and those who just don't think he's for real as a reformer.
What motivated him to make such a dramatic shift? Now, obviously, he was chosen to be the vice president because he was useful, having connections with New York. But what motivated him to shift focus to such a degree that he embittered, you know, people who might have otherwise supported him if they had continued with the same type of presidency that they had expected Garfield to have provided?
Right. I can give you what I consider to be a relatively informed opinion, but it's not definitive. Arthur did not leave behind any written records of what happened, what's going on inside of him. And he doesn't have people to whom he talked who recorded anything about what's going on inside him. So we're not sure positively, but I think that Arthur was deep down inside still a man, an honest man. He had pushed that aside to help the machine in New York and to help himself, frankly, make a lot of money and rise up. He didn't, again, personally take bribes, but he was making a lot of money through his position, legitimately, and working for the party in terms of, as I mentioned before, forcing those who worked under him in the Port of New York to pay dues. Maybe you might put dues in quotation marks to the Republican Party. I think he was a man who now saw the enormity of being president. I'm not just collector of the Port of New York. I'm not just an instrument of the conquering machine. I'm president of all the people. And I think he really rose to be that.
Had to have been a very sobering occasion, certainly with the circumstances that led him to that position, but then the weight of responsibility that he would carry for 3.5 years. We're going to take a quick break, but we will take we'll be back to continue our conversation. Again, we're talking with Dr. John Pafford. He is the author of Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're talking this afternoon with Dr. John Pafford. He is the author of The Accidental President. Chester A. Arthur served as our president upon the assassination of John Garfield. What is it that you think people should know about who John, who President Arthur was and what he did?
Okay, there are several factors that were very outstanding. I should mention one personal point about him, and that was a few months after he took office, he was diagnosed with Bright's disease, which at that time, it's a kidney ailment, and at that time, it was 100% fatal. So that had a somewhat debilitating effect on him, and towards the end of his career, of his presidency, really, fairly seriously debilitating effect, but he rose above that. He did not want that known by the general public for two reasons. One, he didn't want pity. He didn't want to be known as a man who's ill, who's got a disease. He only lived about 18 months after he left the presidency, but he didn't want that known. He didn't want pity, and he also did not want to weaken his position as president by having people decide that here's a man who's got a terminal disease, we really don't have to worry about him. Now, what he accomplished, I think the most significant thing that he did that's positive about his administration was his undertaking the revival of the U.S. Navy. The American Navy, at the end of the American Civil War in 1865, was second only to the British Navy in terms of power. But as all too often happens, after we Americans finish fighting a war, we lose interest in the armed forces and we become weak and then have to wake up, take a look at reality, that this is not a nice, sweet world with everyone nice to everyone else. And especially for the United States, it was necessary to revive the Navy since we were becoming the most powerful economy in the world. We're close to achieving that position. And so Arthur undertook that revival. In 1880, when the Garfield-Arthur Tingle was elected, the American Navy was ranked 12th in the world, and in some respects it was even worse than that, because a number of our ships were too archaic to be effective at sea, and a lot of the others were simply coast defense vessels that could not defend our interests beyond our immediate coastal waters. So we undertook that revival, and by the end of the next decade, the United States will do very well in the Spanish-American War. The American Navy will be in a powerful and effective force. So Garfield is the one who stopped that progressive decline from 1865 to 1880. He stopped that progressive decline and reversed it. He also undertook civil service reform. Even then, as well as today, of course, each administration, when it comes in, wants to have the top officials representing its values and its party. But there still was the determination to get the middle-level and lower-level people in government staying in office throughout it, through administrations. And so civil service reform started under Arthur with the passage of the Pendleton Act, which did provide that 10% of the federal government employees would be covered. So that's a second very significant thing he did.
Was there anything surprising about his presidency as you dug deeper into his legacy?
That key thing that he wasn't, I should say if I had been living at the time, I would have been surprised. I was very impressed with the fact that he rose above being a machine politician. As I got into studying him further, though, what I did find was that the revival of the Navy was more significant than I had figured, and the civil service reform more important than I had known earlier. He was a sound money man. He was a gold standard advocate. And also I did find extremely impressive his vetoing a major pork barrel bill in 1882. That's the Rivers and Harbors Act. Between 1875 and 1882, we had tripled the amount of money we were spending on rivers and harbors. Some of that, of course, obviously was good, but a lot of that was pork barrel stuff, patronage stuff. And even at that time, when we had more limited government, much lower taxation rates, we still did have some government and we had taxation. And so there were people with their hands in the cookie jar.
What were some of the
Rivers and Harbors Act? He vetoed it, passed over his veto, but he really impressed people immensely with the fact that he did take that strong stand in opposition to a lot of his machine politician buddies.
Let me ask you, what were some of his flaws? No president is perfect, and he certainly stepped up to the challenge of serving after the assassination of the president he served under. What were some of his weaknesses for this unexpected leader who surprised everyone at the time?
Well, that's a good question. I don't really have anything significant of a moral nature that he was wrong in terms of principle on this issue, or he did something that was dishonest, or he really did something that was absolutely stupid. Now, again, he's going to be in for that 3.5-year period. He's going to be fighting a lot of the machine politicians on the way. And so I really don't have, let me stop for a moment. You can find some areas where he does make some concessions to political reality. It depends on who you are as to whether you would castigate him for that. So, for example, the Chinese Exclusion Act, passed legislation to limit for 20 years, in fact, to bar for 20 years any more Chinese coming into this country. Initially, the Chinese coming into this country were hotel and restaurant owners. They were skilled artisans. But then after the Civil War, we were getting a lot of low-skilled, less educated people coming in to work on the railroads and on the farms. And that caused resentment by American workers because the Chinese would work for less than an American wanted. And so there was legislation that passed Congress to prohibit any immigration of Chinese at all for a 20-year period. He did veto that, and there was a sort of a compromise worked out that postponed it for 20 years, for 10 years, postponed it for 10 years. But there you can say he's acknowledging political reality. He's not going to take a stand in principle just for principle's sake alone when he's going to get annihilated for that. And so he did work out a compromise.
What can we learn from Arthur's presidency today?
I think the key thing would be that if you have made a hash of your life up until your middle years, then you still can change, you still can reform, you still can rise above that. And I think a key thing we should still look into politically is this idea of sound money, limited spending, and the fact that we do need strong armed forces to protect our citizens.
Well,
he's not unique in that. Other presidents have done the same, but he's not that well known for those stands.
Well, Chester A. Arthur, the accidental president, is worth learning about. He is a part of our national history, and it does inspire you to perhaps look at your own failures and shortcomings as just roadblocks that are temporary, that there may be greatness yet ahead. Dr. Pafford, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Again, Chester A. Arthur, The Accidental President. The book is a Regnery History book.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the final segment of the Georgene Rice Show. Tomorrow on the program, I'm looking forward to a conversation with Jeff Lucas. He's the author of a notorious and integrated study of the rogues, scoundrels, and scallywags of Scripture. Wow, scallywags. He'll be my guest tomorrow. On Wednesday, a conversation with Glenn Sunshine, The Kingdom Unleashed, How Jesus' First Century Kingdom Values Are Transforming Thousands of Cultures and Awakening His Church. And then on Thursday, we're going to talk with Andrew McCarthy. His book is titled Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig and Destroy a Presidency. The book is published by Encounter. Looking forward to that conversation on Thursday. There was an interesting article in Christianity Today, its most recent issue. In fact, you can find it online, having to do with Pastor Andrew Brunson. He was the pastor who was for 20 years had served as a pastor in Turkey and spent 2 years in a Turkish prison. He was asked a series of questions about his view of the time that he spent for those 2 years in that Turkish prison, in which he was sorely discouraged by it all, but also puts it into a much broader perspective that I think might help all of us when we face things as, well, unserious, as light opposition to a biblical worldview. Well, many of the Christians that we admire most, they've been in prison for the cause of Christ. Believers like Corrie ten Boom, Richard Wurmbrand are remembered as giants of the faith, and rightfully so. Their perseverance is notable. They were blessed with a peculiar sense of God's power and presence, even in the midst of extreme suffering. In God's Hostage, A True Story of Persecution, Imprisonment, and Perseverance, pastor and missionary Andrew Brunson, his new book provides a raw account of his experience as a prisoner in the Turkish government, or prisoner of the Turkish government. His story of doubt as well as faith, of depression as well as hope, is covered in that story. He says of himself and his wife, Noreen, she and I were missionaries in Turkey for 23 years. We never tried to hide our work. We were surprised when we were detained. There was an attempted coup in 2016, but that didn't change the views of the government leaders. I think it just gave them the opportunity to do many things they'd wanted to do before. It had nothing to do with our arrest. It just created a very tense environment. When they called us in, we thought we were getting our residence permits, but then they said, no, you're being arrested for deportation. Noreen was released after 13 days, but they kept me, Pastor Brunson writes. There are several reasons, and they changed over time. But the big thing that they wanted to make an example of somebody, of a missionary, to intimidate other missionaries so that they would self-deport. And they also wanted to intimidate local believers. At some point, the government decided to keep me as a political pawn, a bargaining chip. They wanted concessions from the United States. That stretched on, as you might recall, into 2 years. He goes on by saying, there are two issues here, one human and one spiritual. I think there was a larger drama going behind the political dealings, which was God's story, what he was accomplishing through my imprisonment. Well, there were two great fears that he writes about, great fears in prison, losing his faith and losing his mind. He writes that whatever you're going through, if you're working for Christ and his kingdom, then it is very precious to him. Throughout the day, I would repeat to myself that there was purpose in my suffering, that God was involved in it, and that it had eternal value because it was suffered for his sake. It's especially important, I'd say, to guard against resentment. I felt abandoned by God, and in those circumstances, it was easy to let my heart grow cold. When it seemed like God wasn't answering my pleas for his presence, I would imagine a box where I would lock away all my questions and doubts and refuse to entertain them anymore. As Noreen, his wife, reminded him, whatever doubts you have, God remains the same. He is faithful. He is true. He is loving. He is good. Well, he writes that my crisis of faith wasn't a matter of being imprisoned. That's persecution, and the book of James promised it would happen. That's James chapter 1, verse 2. It was more the feeling of abandonment. I had expected strength to pour into me. I had expected to feel an overwhelming sense of grace. When this didn't happen, I became suicidal. I had questions about his love, loyalty, and faithfulness. But really, he had questions for me. Are you going to be loyal? Are you going to love me? Are you going to remain faithful even if you feel abandoned and disappointed? I was being tested and it was painful. But when your faithfulness is tested and proven true, there's such a great reward. It brings you to a new level of intimacy with God. One thing I really tried to focus on was cultivating the fear of God, he writes, having an eternal perspective, seeing things through his eyes. I knew that if I feared God the way Isaiah did, I would be more willing to undergo any hardship, which would confirm that he is worthy of all my pain and suffering. I also held fast to the promise that God will make all things right in the end. That doesn't mean thirsting for vengeance. It just means that while Jesus is portrayed as a lamb, pure, innocent, sacrificial, he is also portrayed as a fierce lion. Someday, those who persecute my brothers and sisters are going to encounter Jesus. They will encounter him as a lamb if they surrender to him, or else they will encounter him as a lion. They will meet him, and he will make all things right. He was asked about the epilogue to his new book. He describes how his story was a small part of a bigger story that God was weaving. And Pastor Brunson writes, in 2009, I believe God was calling me to Turkey to prepare a harvest of souls for Christ. In 2016, when we were detained, my thought was, wait, this can't be. This seems like God's cutting the assignment short. But I learned to see my imprisonment as a crucial part of preparing for harvest, mainly because of the worldwide prayer movement it started. This was something God initiated, God sustained, God driven. A tsunami of prayers crashed into Turkey. It's as if God were saying, I can take you out, but if you're willing to stay, I will do something greater. Well, in the book, he emphasizes strongly the love for the nation that he has for the people of Turkey, and some of his hopes and prayers for that country. And he writes, when we talk about our love for Turkey, we're not talking about Turkish food or culture, although we do love those things. No, we're really talking about a determined commitment to seek the good of the Turkish people, whether they appreciate it or not. It's a love that's demonstrated in faithfulness to our assignment. But right now, I'm relatively pessimistic about Turkey. A number of missionaries have been deported just in this past year, and I think there's a time of persecution coming. There will be a harvest under God's power, but it will happen under difficult circumstances, which is a reminder to those of us looking on to keep them in prayer. Well, he mentions that however terrible the prison ordeal was, you do miss being so completely dependent on God. How can we cultivate that kind of intimacy with God wherever life finds us? And he answers that question. Extreme circumstances are sometimes necessary to push us toward God. If you find yourself now in an extreme circumstance, listen to what he has to say. Without them, our natural inclination is to decline in faithfulness, and we have to be deliberate about cultivating it. Sometimes I'll find myself praying, "Lord, I'm not hungry for you, but I really want to be." As my wife would say, there's no substitute for time spent with God. When I wake up each morning, I try to focus myself by saying, "Jesus, the only thing that matters is what you think about me when I stand before you. So I want to live accordingly. I want all of my efforts to have your glory in mind." That's what I encourage other people to do as well. We certainly are not facing the kind of persecution that he lived with and through for 2 years in a Turkish prison, but it is a reminder to us all that we are responsible for making sure that we are staying close in our commitment and our fidelity to Christ. Remember to pray for the church in Turkey. As Pastor Brunson suggested, there is a harvest coming, but it will come through great peril, and that has already begun. Once again, tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with Jeff Lucas. He's the author of Notorious, an integrated study of the rogues, scoundrels, and scallywags of Scripture. The book is published by David C. Cook, and he'll be my guest in the first hour of tomorrow's program. I want to thank James Blend for producing today's program, Clark Hilton for engineering, and thank you for making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.